Right now, most churches are planning their budgets for 2009. Your church can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by joining the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to include $1,000 in their mission or advertising budgets. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 on the sponsors page at issuesetc.org. Don't miss your congregation's budget deadline. Download the flyer and present it to your congregation today.
President-elect Barack Obama, bless us so that we might follow and we might truly make the time when your kingdom might come here on earth.
Congratulations. All of my gay friends, I'm like, when are you getting married? I want wedding.
It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself. But this war is for the soul of America.
I am absolutely convinced that culture wars are just so 90s. Their days are growing dark. It is time to turn the page. We want a new day.
It's often said that science is just science. It is morally neutral. In fact, the way I hear the conversation or the debate sometimes go, at least those who claim to be speaking for the advancement of science and inquiry almost seem to imply that science is not only morally neutral, it's morally, immune to any kind of criticism or consideration. Is this true? We're going to be talking about the myth of a morally neutral science for the first half hour of Issues Etc. Today, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Tuesday, November the 12th. It is Veterans Day, and a happy Veterans Day to all those who serve and have served us in that particular dangerous line of work. Our guest for the first half hour, Dr. Yuval Levin, will be speaking with him. He's author of the book Imagining the Future, Science and American Democracy. Audio open lines follows that. We'll have some from NBC News, an interview with San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, his reaction to the gay marriage ban in California, that constitutional amendment. Dr. Dan Gard will join us on this Veterans Day to talk about military chaplaincy to start off the second hour of the program. And then Dr. Ron Rhodes will cover the subject of angels for the last part of the program. Now, you can join us for the next 2 hours. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Or you can email your questions or your comments to us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Yuval Levin is a former executive director of the President's Council on Bioethics. He's director of the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Bioethics and American Democracy Program, his new book, Imagining the Future. Dr. Levin, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's rumored, perhaps more than rumored, that President-elect Barack Obama is going to reverse President Bush's 2001 decision that would have limited or that did limit funding for embryonic stem cell research. Your reaction?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, it's more than rumored. It's now been confirmed by President-elect Obama and the people around him that that's one of the first things he's going to do. What they don't say is really what's involved in this and what the decision really means in terms of the ethical concerns that have to guide science policy as they have to guide all policy. The president's 2001 decision was to support stem cell research in every way that the government could without using taxpayer dollars to encourage the destruction of embryos. It's a decision that tried to find a middle ground, saying that some embryo-destructive research had been done in the past before there was federal funding, and research that uses the results of that could continue, but there could not be new destruction of embryos going forward in the future with taxpayer dollars. The reason, of course, is that these human embryos are human beings in the earliest stages of their lives, and President Bush saw that and decided that it simply wasn't right for the government to force taxpayers to support the destruction of these embryos. What the president-elect has said in the past about this issue is really characteristic of what a lot of people on the left say about this kind of question. He's tried to turn it into an argument between science and anti-science rather than what it really is, an ethical argument. And unfortunately, we've been hearing that again this week, and it seems like he's going to reverse the policy.
Why does, generally speaking, why does the future of a free society, our free society, depend, at least in part, on our willingness to engage the moral questions that are being raised in and around science?
Well, the questions that this all raises really are questions about the future of our ability to govern ourselves. Science, of course, brings us enormous benefits. It empowers us over certain kinds of natural limitations. It helps the sick. It helps the suffering. But it also raises serious problems when it turns to human beings, when the question is, how will science treat humanity? And one of the things that the advocates of science have always tried to do, really since the birth of modern science 400 years ago, is to say that moral questions do not touch on the practice of science, that science is somehow neutral on these questions and just gives us power and lets us decide how to use them. The fact is that's a mistake in two directions. First of all, a lot of what science does has a moral purpose, including helping the sick, of course. On the other hand, science also raises important moral problems, and these are problems that science cannot solve on its own. They're problems that society has to address, and that in the way that we govern our behavior in general, we have to also govern science to make sure that human dignity and human equality and the sanctity of life are protected. If we lose sight of that, if we decide that medical progress is more important than respect for human beings, then we lose the whole purpose of medical progress. We lose the moral underpinning of the whole effort, and we become a kind of aimless technological society, something we unfortunately have seen in the past 100 years around the world, and that we certainly wouldn't want to see here in the United States.
I remember hearing many when the embryonic stem cell research issue was more in the fore of people's minds, many saying, look, we need to maintain the freedom of scientific inquiry and of research, and there are all sorts of cures right around the corner for us. And of course, there need to be some solid ethical guidelines. And yet the very things that they were talking about required, if you were to buy into them, like the destruction of human embryos, at least in that narrow case, the suspension of all moral guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. The way this argument often works is they will say that any issue that has any kind of scientific component is a scientific issue, and therefore politics should have nothing to do with it. The stem cell debate is a classic example. The stem cell debate is not a scientific debate. It's a moral debate. It starts from two premises that I think we can all agree on, that the research involved could help medical progress, and that the research requires the destruction of human embryos. These are two facts. Now, the question is it right to do it? Is it right to destroy these developing human lives for medical research? That's not a scientific question. It's a moral question. And to argue that it's pure science is not a way to win the argument. It's a way to avert the argument. And too often, that's exactly what we see. We see an effort to keep society from thinking about these issues and to just say, move ahead, it's medical research, there's nothing to worry about, when in fact, the future of our respect for human dignity and morality are at stake here.
Does it sound to you, as I said before, it sounds to me sometimes the proponents of various lines of research or of inquiry are trying to declare science and its enterprises immune from moral scrutiny?
Yeah, I think that's quite right. The assumption, the underlying assumption, is that all that science is doing is just seeking after knowledge, and of course nobody could be against that. But the fact is that's not all that science is doing. Science acts, and science acts often, especially in biotechnology, acts on human beings, and it raises the question of what is the proper way to regard and to act toward human beings. That's a question that can't be averted by just saying this is science. One of the things that I talk about in the book, Imagining the Future, is this way in which the left in particular, there are some on the right who do this as well, try to use the fact that what's involved here is medical research to present the case for this science as an emergency, that we have to suspend the rules for the sake of this emergency, of this advancement of medical research. But of course, there are always going to be people in need of help. There are always going to be people who are sick and suffering, and we cannot treat our everyday life and our permanent human condition as an emergency. We have to develop rules of ethics and morality for living day to day, and we can't suspend these rules just because what's involved is science.
It also, and you cite one example of if there's a fertility clinic on fire and mm-hmm. there's a five-year-old in there, which would you prefer to save, five frozen embryos or the grown five-year-old that's in the burning fertility clinic? It seemed to me that that particular scenario It seems disingenuous to me, as though you would have to choose between
the two. That's a perfect example of this kind of crisis mentality, right? So the argument goes, you're in a clinic, there's a fire, there are a large number of embryos, or there's one child. Who would save the embryos over the child? Well, okay, I think it's certainly true to say that most people would save the crying child. But think about what that means. That's equivalent to saying if you were in a clinic and there's a fire, you can save either your wife or a total stranger. Certainly you'd save your wife, but that doesn't then give you the right to go around killing strangers on purpose to take their organs for medical research. So that's basically what this example argues, and it doesn't make any sense.
Can politicians be trusted to regulate and govern science? About 1 minute.
Well, you know, the fact is they have to be, because that's the way we govern ourselves in a democracy. And the argument that science is too complicated or too technical or too important to be governed by our democratic system cannot possibly be taken seriously in a democracy. And so our politicians, through the advice that they receive from their constituents and from experts, have got to govern this, and they cannot be afraid to do it. Too often we find that politicians are afraid of dealing with science. They think that it's too much for them to handle. But in fact, the questions they face are basic ethical and moral questions, and they've got to take them seriously.
Dr. Yuval Levin is our guest. We're talking with him about the myth of a morally neutral science Tuesday, November the 11th. Feel free to join us. 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE, our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Levin is former executive director of the President's Council on Bioethics, director of the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Bioethics and American Democracy Program. He's author of the new book, Imagining the Future, Science and American Democracy. You'll find information on this book under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. You'll find more about imagining the future. When we come back, I want to pick up on that idea, this notion that there are scientists and then there are the rest of us, and the rest of us are really not qualified to inquire into or to regulate and govern this complicated effort called science. We'll be right back. On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc., Pastor Timothy Ostermeyer, Beth Mummy, Dwayne and Brenda Telly, Sarah Cody, John Yeasel, Pastor Fred Gerlach, Arlene Smyer, Jacqueline Gathman, Richard Telly, and Larry Lee, thanks for your support.
What is it, Captain?
Whatever it is, it's incredibly advanced.
Hey, iPhone users, you can now listen to Issues Etc. live on your iPhone. Find out by going to piratechristianradio.com and click the iPhone link on the homepage. You no longer have to sit by your PC, laptop, or home radio to listen to Issues Etc. live. piratechristianradio.com and look for the iPhone icon.
With something much, much more. And it's going to change everything.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
618-223-8384. It's the new phone number for the Issues Etc. listener comment line. 618-223-8384. Leery about calling a live radio talk show? Want to remain anonymous? Leave your recorded question or comment on the Issues Etc. comment line. 618-223-8384. The good, the bad, the ugly. We're big boys. We can take it. 618-223-8384.
A lot of us across this country are really thankful to be hearing your voices again.
Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, with his thoughts on the return of Issues Etc.
It's great to be with you guys on Issues Etc. Welcome back. A lot of us across this country are really thankful to be hearing your voices again. It's always great to be with you guys.
We're talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at www.issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the moral impact of science for the next 10 minutes. Dr. Yuval Levin is our guest. Then we'll have some audio open lines to share with you. NBC News had an interview with San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom on the gay marriage ban out there in California that went into effect on Tuesday. We'll see what he has to say, and we'll get your reaction to it as well. Audio open lines in about 10 minutes. You mentioned something before the break, Dr. Levin, that it's commonly believed, in your dealing with politicians in Washington, I'm sure that it's commonly believed by them, that science is too specialized and really too complex to be efficiently governed by our government or even by the will of the consent of the governed. What are your thoughts there?
There definitely is that view. It's very common, and it's to my mind, the greatest challenge to American self-government today comes from this sort of attitude, which is that we're just not up to it, that there are issues that are too technical, too complex to be dealt with by the people through their representatives. What that really shows me is a failure to understand the fundamental issues that are presented by advances in science that raise moral concerns. Politicians don't have to become experts in biology. They don't have to become experts in biochemistry to understand these things. The questions that are presented are very fundamental questions. Do we believe that human beings are equal? Do we believe that human beings have a fundamental dignity? Do we believe that there are certain protections that every human being merits by virtue of being a human being? These are not questions. You know, we heard during the election campaign Senator Obama saying that this was all above his pay grade. I think politicians cannot think that way. This is part of what we elect them to do, which is to govern on these very difficult questions that raise important moral issues. And the resources are certainly out there for them to come to understand how these issues are not fundamentally technical, but moral and ethical and political. And if they cannot do that, then we are in really grave trouble. And unfortunately, more and more, you do hear that attitude.
You say that the real science debates are not properly understood as arguments between scientists and non-scientists. So where are the lines of the debate really drawn?
Well, that's right. There's a tendency, and there's long been a tendency thought of in academic circles as the problem of the two cultures, which is scientists compose a kind of culture of their own, and it's hard for laymen to understand them, and it's hard for them to understand the layman. I don't think that's where the problem is. I think what we have is a real division in our culture between two camps who think very differently about the future. That is part of the reason that my book is entitled Imagining the Future. What we differ on is whether, when we think about the future, we ought to think in terms of innovations, in terms of choices, or whether we ought to think in terms of obligations and generations. That is, whether we ought to think about the challenge that every society always faces of bringing a new generation to the world, teaching them properly how to live moral lives in the world, and allowing them to then carry that on further into the future. If that is how you think, then the problems that science presents are very clear, because they are problems to our sense of who we are as human beings, and therefore to our ability to educate the next generation through the proper moral instruction. If what you think about are innovations and choices, then all you think about is the present. You think about how do we improve the lives of people who are here now. And you don't really think about the effect that has on our ability to educate the future generations. That's a huge distinction between left and right in general, and it presents itself especially starkly in the science debates.
Is science guilty of, not science in general, those who advocate kind of unfettered scientific inquiry and research, are they guilty of holding a utopian carrot before the nose of the American people?
I think there is a lot of that in science debates. There's a lot of this notion that our problems are going to be fundamentally solved by science, that our problems are material problems, excuse me, and that science offers solutions to these, and therefore, if we let it proceed, we'll find ourselves in a world, say, without disease or without poverty or without war. Take your permanent problem, and there it goes. This has been a part of the scientific worldview since the very beginning, and it's when science is taken to be more than it is, when science is thought to be a substitute for politics and morality, that we begin to see the consequences of this way of thinking. Basically, it creates a kind of moral vacuum, and the only things that sneak into that moral vacuum are utilitarian ways of thinking about human beings, of sort of how do we solve our material problems without thinking about the moral and ethical problems that are always with us and always have to be dealt with, regardless of how much material progress we might make.
Has the American right been waging war on science?
Well, obviously, that's one of the accusations you hear, and certainly my view is no. I think the American right has been friendly to science in every possible way within the bounds of the ethical views that guide us in politics. This administration, for example, the Bush administration, has vastly increased funding for scientific research, medical research, research in the physical sciences. But at the same time, it has said that there are certain lines that can't be crossed. And, of course, it's around those lines that these debates take place. And people who want to argue that the only thing at stake is science rather than ethical and moral questions will respond to this by saying that this makes the Bush administration or Republicans or conservatives anti-science. But, of course, neither side here is anti-science or pro-science. The question is, where are the moral boundaries?
Well, in that vein, since you mentioned our present administration for the time being, opinion polls, as you well know, are pretty bad for President Bush. But do you think he will go down as the most pro-life president in our nation's history?
Well, I think in terms of what he has done, in terms of practice, he probably should go down as our most pro-life president. I think that in terms of the regulations he has put in place, in terms of the laws that he has pushed the Congress to pass and then signed, like the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, like the partial birth abortion ban, and in terms of justices that he's put on the Supreme Court, I certainly think that his record is unblemished and his record is very impressive. Now, there have been pro-life presidents before. Of course, Ronald Reagan is an outstanding example. And Ronald Reagan, in some ways, made the argument more forcefully and more powerfully. But if you judge a president by what he does in office, I certainly think it's hard to find a more pro-life president than George W. Bush.
President-elect Barack Obama, 1 year ago, promised Planned Parenthood Action Fund that he was going to sign into law the Freedom of Choice Act in about a minute. What is the Freedom of Choice Act, and why is it wrong?
Well, the Freedom of Choice Act is an extraordinarily radical piece of legislation. Basically, what it would do is take the logic of Roe v. Wade and put it into statute. It would roll back all of the existing limitations and boundaries on the practice of abortion. For example, it would eliminate all of the state requirements for parental notification when a minor has an abortion. It would eliminate all of the protections for physician conscience so that pro-life doctors are not compelled to perform abortions or else lose their jobs. It would eliminate the restriction against taxpayer funding of abortion so that, for example, the Medicaid program would start using our tax money to pay for abortions. It's an extraordinarily radical piece of legislation. As you say, the president-elect has said that he would support it. There would be a huge fight if the Democrats were to bring it up. And it's not entirely clear that even now, after this election, they actually have the numbers in the House of Representatives to pass something so radical, although they may very well try, and they may even have the numbers. I think that if it comes up, it would certainly be the most important pro-life fight that we've seen in America in many, many years.
Two quick final questions. You conclude your book by saying that public bioethics is essential. With 30 seconds, what do you mean?
Well, what that means is that we have to make arguments, that conservatives, especially in these bioethics debates, have to present an alternative view to the utilitarianism of the left, to the notion that all that matters is health and safety. We have to make a positive case for why what's implicated in these arguments are our basic moral views about the importance of human dignity and the sanctity of life, the defense of life. And we can't just wait to have a congressional majority and then pass a bill. We've got to make that argument all the time to our neighbors, to our fellow citizens. It has to be a crucial part of what the pro-life movement does in America.
Then finally, is science morally neutral?
Well, I think it isn't. I think that science can serve important moral purposes, especially the advancement of medicine and helping the sick. But science can also raise important moral problems. And in neither of those cases is it morally neutral. It has to be understood as a huge and important human endeavor. And like all the others, it has very important moral consequences that have to be taken seriously.
Dr. Yuval Levin is former executive director of the President's Council on Bioethics, director of the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Bioethics and American Democracy Program. His new book, Imagining the Future, Science and American Democracy. Find out more about it at our webpage, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Look for Imagining the Future, issuesetc.org. Dr. Levin, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
When we come back from this break, a little schedule change. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute will be our guest. We'll be talking with him
about some of the legislation that was in the mix during the general election, some of it having to do with protection of the unborn via kind of broad philosophical lawmaking, and the other, more particularly, a right to die bill in the state of Washington. Wesley will address some of those questions on the other side of this break. You can join us with your questions or your comments as the second half hour of Issues Etc. continues. 1-877-623-6943, 1-877-623-MYIE, or email questions and comments to us right here in the studio. It's Tuesday afternoon, November the 11th. Talk back at issuesetc.org. Talk back at issuesetc.org. You see, we simply don't have the luxury of saying science, it should be the realm only of the scientists. We're talking about our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, not our future, but think more about their future. And for their sake, we don't have the luxury of saying, look, those are complicated moral questions that are above our pay grade. If we don't want our president to say that, if we think it's wrong that the president should try to exempt himself from the moral questions that science raises, then we shouldn't be willing to exempt ourselves. Remember, this is, in fact, a country where we are governed by the consent of our neighbors, you and me. We need to know what this means and how to deal with those questions. We'll be right back. Wesley Smith is next.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Historic liturgy, cool. Liturgical dance, not cool. Kneeling for the Lord's body and blood on a Sunday morning, cool. Sitting in your theater-style seat with couple if you're a double mocha latte, not cool. We're the Brothers of John the Steadfast. If you're interested in traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice, check us out. www.steadfastlutherans.com.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
A first-of-its-kind trial has begun in California. Rosa Navarro says a surgeon who was working on a now-defunct kidney transplant program hastened the death of her son, Ruben. The young man, who had various health problems, had been taken off a ventilator and prepared for organ donation. Nurses present in the operating room told police the doctor ordered excessive doses of morphine and a sedative, which hastened Ruben's death. If convicted, the doctor could face 4 years in prison. This case is being closely watched by the medical community. It could have a profound impact on the perception of how organs are procured for transplantation, and it may change the procedures medical personnel use to harvest human organs for transplantation.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Cassandra Shirk, Pastor David Putz, Pastor Barry Long, Jacqueline Klug, Lawrence Young, Marla Schmidt, Calvin Vanderlinde, Ron Kinsel Jr., Henry Glass, and Barbara Gershner. Thanks for your support.